The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately? Well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold on the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yep, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
You need reliable appliances to help you conquer the day. And Menards is the one-stop shop for huge savings on new energy-efficient appliances. We carry the largest in-stock selection, starting at low prices and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Upgrade today and save big money on new appliances right now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
All right, execute. Welcome everybody to another episode of the Afterburn Podcast. We got a good show today. This is gonna be awesome. We got two guests, two co-host guests. We got Kelso Flick and we got Gunn Dorrell. Here to talk about some CSAR and applications to business, applications to civilian, lessons that we can learn from some of those things. For those out there, CSAR, Combat Search and Rescue, a incredibly critical mission that is owned primarily by the United States Air Force with a lot of different things and means and methods that you can go about to actually execute this, and then the overall spectrum of CSAR, and we're going to get into all of it today. So first off, Kelso, Gunn, thanks for the time. Welcome. And let's get to it. But before we get kind of started, Kelso, let's go ahead. Tell us about yourself. No tricks. Tell us about yourself. A couple minutes, where you are, what you're doing, and what you're going to talk about today.
Sure thing. So Ridge Kelso Flick was an Academy grad in 2010. Went through pilot training down in Del Rio. B course for A-10s out in Davis-Monthan. Went out to South Korea at Osan, did 3 years out there. Ironically, got my call sign because I was one of the worst combat search and rescue survivors in history. But that's a three beer story. So I don't see you buying any beers for me right now. Flash, I'll tell that story when you do. And then I went from there out to Davis-Monthan. I was at Davis-Monthan for 3.5 years with weapon school and two deployments mixed into that 3.5 year span. So not a lot of time at home, but a lot of time learning, a lot of time figuring out how we do business. And then I went back to the weapons school and I was teaching there from 2020 to 2022. And then I got an assignment out to Langley Air Force Base. I'm out here at Langley now on the staff, just staffing it up, having a great time. So that's me in a nutshell.
Love it. And you guys probably remember Kelso on the Hog Bro Chat episode that was previously aired. So with there, Kelso, welcome back, but, Gunn, go ahead, take it away.
Yeah. Thanks. Great to be here. I appreciate the opportunity. So went to Kent State, grew up in New Jersey, went to Kent State in Ohio for a couple of different reasons. Maybe we'll get into that shortly, but, I'm old enough that I went to fixed wing pilot training advance. So I did T-37s, T-38s, and then we didn't track back then. And, Flash, we were talking a little bit before. So they were doing this thing called third pilot, and it didn't really sound interesting because nobody really knew what it was. So I'm like, well, let me try helicopters. That sounds interesting. Originally supposed to go to Iceland, got diverted to Florida. So somewhat of a beach location. And then the unit moved from there, from Patrick. They were getting rid of the H-3, which was doing the shuttle non-deployable mission. So the Air Force was getting the H-60. So started off in that. Went to the weapons school, and then the unit moved from there up to Moody to be part of the composite wing. Eventually wound up in Iceland, was there for a couple of years, back to the weapons school to teach for a couple of years. 9/11 happens, and then obviously Iraq and Afghanistan. I went to a program out of there called JAWS, so learned how to do joint planning and things like that. After that, I had a really interesting detour. I went to NORAD because it was a joint assignment, worked with a bunch of Canadians, learned a lot about air defense for a helicopter guy, which was fun, and worked in the mountain for a little bit, which was fascinating. And then went from NORAD to be DO and commander down at the 66th Rescue Squadron down at Nellis. They've just recently closed that, unfortunately, but times change and things move on. And then another interesting assignment, went up to the Air Force Academy as a cadet group commander. So that was awesome. Got to fly and got to learn a lot about cadets and leadership. And a whole bunch of
like me and Kelso.
Exactly. Yeah. I thought it was going to be, we could talk about maybe my first 3 days in command that I never thought I'd deal with before, but that's a different story. And then went from there to Air War College and then to group command down at Moody, ran the rescue group. And, a bunch of deployments in there as well. And then finished up my tour in the Air Force at ACC on the staff doing requirements. So kind of seeing the H-60 from a pilot and then also as a requirements guy. Retired in 18, did a bunch of different things. Defense contracting, worked for a large bank, worked for a small tech startup and doing some fly-ins and doing some flying and coaching and consulting now. So it's happy to be here. Nice to meet you all.
That's awesome. All right. I'm sorry. Before we get started, you have to tell me the 3 days in command at the Air Force Academy story. You got to do it.
Okay. So like we were talking, kind of in the pre-chat, Kelso, this is before you were here. So not an Academy grad. I was in Afghanistan and, you fill out your dream sheet of where you want to go. And I'm thinking, okay, it's going to be war college. On-time helicopter pilot. I kind of know my place in the world. So I'm like, great. So a buddy of mine, he was an Academy grad. He calls me. He goes, "Hey, Gunn, I know where you're going." I'm like, "Uh-huh, great." It was kind of a bad night in Afghanistan. It's the summer, and it's got that smell and their cloud. It's just the feeling. And I'm like,
"Unfortunately, he goes, hey, you're going to-"
What's that?
Unfortunately, we do.
Yeah. It's that smell that brings you right back. So he tells me I'm going to the Air Force Academy, and I'm like, "For what?" And he goes, "For school." I'm like, "Well, I'm not, and." I literally hung up on him. I'm like, all right, whatever, dude, I can't. And so he sends me the email and I said, okay, we're going to be a cadet group commander. Call my wife and I said, hey, I think they made a mistake. So we wound up going there. Yeah. Cause I'm like the state school educated helicopter pilot. What in, God's green earth am I doing there? So take command there and it's pretty cool and, do all that stuff. So you have 10 squadrons, with the AOCs and I'm given, kind of a, hey, here's kind of leadership. Here's kind of my expectations and stuff like that. And I said, hey, if you really can't get a hold of me, and we had Blackberries back then. So it's, I'm dating myself, right? We did have technology, but it was Blackberry. I said, hey, if you can't, if you call me, if you've got a problem, email me, but if you really need me, you mean drop everything, just text me 911. Okay, cool. I'm thinking no one ever is going to text me 911. So command, okay, all the parties wore off and then you're running the summer program. And I was running the cadet survival program. So you put the cadets over the mountain over the ridge and all with, Waldo Canyon fire and all that stuff. And I get a text from one of my AOCs and she was a security forces and it just says 911. And I'm like, maybe it's a joke. And then she calls me and she's like, hey, sir, this is so-and-so. And I said, yeah, what's going on? She goes, well, Cadet X is missing. And he was in the process of being, kicked out of the organization. And he kind of stole some things. Anyway, he winds up basically on the lam, and they wind up picking him up in on the border, like Prescott, Arizona, or down there. He was trying to basically get out of the country. And so my belief was going in there, I'm like, this is going to be the easiest assignment ever. I'm like, these are all like the top of the top, you know, valedictorians, salutatorians, easiest assignment. In the first 3 days, you know, it's kind of like that Mike Tyson, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face. And this was my punch in the face. I mean, we had no idea where this young man was going, what he was doing. Finally, we got him under control and brought him back and extradited him and did all that thing. And that was within the first 3 days of taking command. And I remember the commandant at the time said, he goes, welcome to the Air Force Academy.
So, oh my God.
So is this kid a football player or a rugby player? Had to be one of the two.
well, yeah, we might have to go into a skiff to talk about that.
Yeah. There you go. Oh my gosh.
But yeah,
we had the dude sneaking out of Jack's Valley going to try to go to that gas station or the one place that was out there. That was a pretty funny one.
Stories, I remember that.
Stories that cadets try to get away with at the Air Force, or things that cadets try to get away with at the Air Force Academy. That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, let's dive into CSAR. There's a ton to talk about here. So kind of the things that when I think of CSAR, one, I want it to work. As a single seat fighter pilot, like, I want these things to work. And some that I've struggled with across my career is just convincing people that it is a worthy endeavor. It always should be part of the plan. And like, when we kind of go here, and it's something that we've kind of promised the service member in the event that you are isolated, that we are going to go pick you up. So don't really either one of you. Can we start with just like, what is CSAR doctrinally? Like, what is that? And what are you guys supposed to, what is the overall objectives and kind of the history of CSAR?
Yeah, I want to, I'll highlight your point, Flash, about wanting to get picked up real quick. And I'll hit some of the doctrine with it too. So doctrinally, you have personnel recovery, which just means there's somebody out there they need picked up. Okay. And then underneath of that is the branch off where you have combat search and rescue. You also have, you know, unconventional recovery. And then you have kind of your traditional personnel recovery where somebody in training ends up punching out of an airplane over the water. You need to go pick them up. There's no threats or anything. You just actually need to coordinate someone to go pick this person up. That's more of your conventional personal recovery. Yeah. The combat search and rescue branch is more focused on contested recovery, where you're going to have somebody shot down in enemy territory. You're going to have to fight your way in. You're going to need to pick them up, and you're going to have to fight your way out, because any isolated person that's in enemy territory kind of becomes a way for the enemy to leverage us against ourselves. They're going to either try to set up some kind of a trap, or they're going to try to capture that person to use them for propaganda or classified information. And the part that's funny is you saying you want to get picked up. I was reading about the Battle of Britain as part of my online master's program. And they specifically cite how when the British were initially going out for intercepts, they were going out over the water and trying to intercept the Germans. And when somebody would get shot down, it was like 90% of them that were dying because the British did not have a maritime search and rescue force. So they started completely reframing their tactics and trying to intercept the Germans over land so that if a pilot got shot down, when they ejected, they could be recovered and brought back into the force because they were running out of pilots. It wasn't aircraft they were running out of at that time. It was pilots. Which you can easily see how that can happen when you start spinning up industrial side, getting aircraft pumped out of the line. And all of a sudden you're like, it takes me a long time to build these people. It's taking me a longer time to build the people than it's taking me to build the aircraft themselves. Yeah. And that's when it was kind of a come to Jesus for the British of building up a little bit of a maritime search and rescue force in World War II so that they could fly missions over the water and not worry about losing their pilots. That's kind of the doctrine side. Is you've got personnel recovery, branch off under that, combat search and rescue. And then to your point, fly with confidence. Sandy has your back, right? That's been the thing for the longest time of don't worry about getting shot down because somebody's coming for you. We don't leave our own just hanging out by themselves behind enemy lines. We're going to put together large force packages and we're going to commit millions of dollars and lots of weapons to make sure that we can get you home.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would say, I would also add to that, you know, that's on the military side. Of course, there's the non-conventional assisted recovery, the NAR, the, you know, the sneaky peek stuff. And then there's also, there's a lot of stuff on the, if it doesn't work out with the military force on the diplomatic side, you know, Jesse Jackson used to do things like that. I believe Bill Richardson, who was an envoy, or I know he was the governor of New Mexico. So he used to do that thing. So if it didn't work that way, if they captured him after the fact, they would have those diplomatic channels as well. And it really just gives, it gives the national leadership and the combatant commander, you know, tools in the toolkit of what he or she can use to go get that person back.
Or absolutely. Persons. And like the, and the other thing is it is a huge kind of will to fight, just like Kelso was talking about. If it's inefficient and not su- like it is suboptimal to not be able to have the capability to get someone back into the fight. And so, and the fact that if you know that if you're going out on this risky mission and if you get shot down, you're just like, if I get shot down, I'm gone. Period. Dot. End of statement. That is a barrier to will to fight. That is something that is unique to, to a lot of militaries. Like if you're going to be, if you have this capability to kind of execute the, this type of mission, and it's critically important. So, all right. So like the, what I have been, again, you guys are the experts. I'm just a customer and potentially a supporting asset. But so what I've been told is one of the most important products that you need to have before you start a CSAR or PR, is a 15 line. So when we're kind of talking about 15 line, we got lines 1 through 7 and 8 through 15 that are kind of two separate portions of that 15 line. So how is that utilized in the military? And then Gunn, is there any application that you can tie into what you've done post-military in any of your endeavors?
Yeah, I'll tell you, Kelso, if you want to start with that, and I'll throw in some things that I've seen, you know, post-military with the 15 line, that kind of frames it not only for what we're doing in CSAR, but also in business.
Definitely. So the 15 line is essentially the combat search and rescue execution checklist, if you will, right? You're going to start off, the first couple lines are just, what's the call sign of the person I'm trying to pick up? How many people are associated with that call sign at that location? You know, what is the condition of the people that are at that location? So do I have one person with a broken leg, or do I have three people? One of them has some kind of sucking chest wound. Somebody's got a fractured spine and somebody else has a fractured arm. So that we're kind of packaging up information about the survivor in those first handful of lines. Then we get into what equipment do the survivors have? You know, do they have a signal mirror? Do they have a smoke? Do they have their little flare jet pen if they're in the trees and they need to get some kind of signal through a tree canopy? All that stuff gets rolled up in line 5. And then we have a line that is specifically to make sure that we have authenticated that the people we're trying to pick up are actually the same people, right? Because you may have a situation. Yeah, exactly. Like I may have a situation where someone got shot down. They actually got killed while they were like first collecting their parachute and somebody else got a hold of their radio, right? The enemy's got their radio. So I need to make sure that I authenticate that person. And I'm not just going after Panther One. I'm going after Mike Flash McVeigh, and I know things about you that nobody else knows that I can use to authenticate you. And then line 7 is one of the biggest ones, which is what are the threats? And we view it from the survivor all the way out to the bigger picture of the threats to the whole force package. So I go, do I have security forces, enemy guys with dogs, right? That would be a threat to the survivor. Do I have armored personnel carriers that are within a certain number of miles? Do I have any radar guided surface to air missiles or infrared surface to air missiles in the area? And then I build that all the way back to go, do I have any threats that are longer range surface to air missiles that maybe for me and the helicopters, they're not a threat. But if I try to bring Flash and his buddies in to do suppression of enemy air defenses, they need to be thinking about this overarching long range SAM. And once I've built lines 1 through 7, I have kind of framed the entire tactical problem. I've said, here's everything about the survivor. Here's everything about all the threats in the area. Now I know this is what I'm dealing with. Lines 8 through 15 That's when we start building out, what's the plan? How do I actually put together the force package I need? Who's going to be responsible for what? And then what's the end state game plan of how am I bringing the helicopters into this terminal area? Who's going to provide fire support on the close in threats? Who's providing fire support on threats that are a little further away? Are we going to do any kind of diversionary strikes to draw the enemy's attention to different areas? And that's all built into line 13 now, is this big game plan line that has expanded. It used to be, you know, the helicopters are going to fly this formation. Here's what they're going to do after number two lands at the LZ. It's expanded massively. Now you have entire coordinated attack game plans that go in that line. You may have some kind of seed mission priority or a preemptive shot going in, all kinds of crazy stuff. But that's the military side of the 15 line. And I think there's some really great applications of that mental model and that thought process in the business world. So I'll let Gunn hit some of those.
And that, the other thing before, like we talked about that is like the thing about it is like that 15 line has to get built somehow. And so while there's the experts and then there's the rescue vehicle, there's the RV, the thing that's actually going to pick the person up, and A-10s who train to this all the time religiously. But then every person that flies an airplane or is on a boat or a person in the military, like, needs to be aware of how to make a good 15 line. And so that's something that everybody is aware of and something that everybody trains to. Because again, as Gunn is probably about to talk about, is the success of the mission is as good as that product and as good as the information that you have. And that's something that it is interesting to see when people are just like, oh, I don't do CSAR. I was just like, yes, you do. Yes, you do, my friend. But you just have a small role in this PR CSAR kind of game that you need to be very familiar with. And it's important. So, all right. But sorry, Gunn. Sorry to jump in. Take it away.
You know, I think that's a good segue. And they may say they don't do CSAR, but I will say that personal recovery CSAR needs them, because it's a, you know, there's all sorts. And I go back to that tool in the toolkits for whatever, for the combatant commander or the joint force commander, whoever is making the call to go, okay, execute, you know, build this plan, commit more forces to go get whatever the call sign is. It could be one. It could be 10. It could be X number of people.
Could be a civilian. Single-seated.
Yeah, it might be.
It has been.
You're exactly. And you know, there was, I think, a McKay trophy where they picked up, I think it was a CH-47 that crashed. I can't remember the number of survivors, but I think it was more than 10. And that's a very complex problem. But I think also, you know, to frame it in the 1 through 7, it's the problem solving. And really, you could almost take a SWOT analysis, you know, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and then threats. You know, Kelso, you talk, I'll kind of work backwards with that. Threats, that's going to really drive what we come up with in the plan. And the threat could be, it could be, you know, a missile, could be someone with a radio. It could be the terrain too. You know, in Afghanistan, there was rescues going on, you know, 9,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 feet. And sometimes if it's hot, obviously, helicopters really don't like that, and that just degrades the performance, and that tends to somewhat be a threat, and then that even moves into a weakness for us, because we may not be able to pick up 5 people, maybe only pick up 1 for weight and everything like that. And even during things like Anaconda, they had some challenges that they had to work through. But also it's also about building that SA through multiple data sources. You know, when I started doing this, we didn't have things like Saddle, we didn't have Link 16. You know, we barely had secure radios. We were talking about, are you on the right net? Did you get the Mickey? You know, do you have the right fills? No, we used last week's. It's just and there's always a communication problem. I know we're going to unpack that later, but it's what data sources and intel feeds are you going to use? And I think in the business world, it's, you know, trade groups, it's social media, it's what hashtag is trending. And then what is the C-suite looking at of, you know, if you're selling something, and, you know, you watch people like Elon Musk or Bill Gates or some of the leaders in business, they're always looking at what's trending and what's selling, and they're looking at different intel streams. And I think, you know, that can help you figure out where the market or whatever market you're in. Now, if we take that as the business analogy, if CSAR is the market for what we're doing, there's going to be strengths. You know, we're going to have multiple, you know, strikers and, you know, A-10s and other things like that, you know, national assets. We're going to have helicopters, we're going to have ground force and all that stuff. And then the weakness might be, you know, we've talked 1 through 7. One of the things is the condition of the survivor. I mean, can they walk? Little things like that. And you compare that to the business world of what is the problem you're trying to solve, and using that application and using those multiple data sources. And sometimes it's maybe what we see, but it's also what the customer, you know, we always talk about the customer, which is Jack in this place, in this scenario. What can he or she give us on the ground? They probably have the best example of what's going on, you know, and there's great stories, I think, you know, from General Goldfein when he was picked up, and some of the feedback he had, and even Vega, and gosh, even Scott O'Grady that the Marine Corps picked up years ago. And then the second half, you know, is the solution lines 8 through 15. There's all sorts of wonderful applications, you know, gathering ideas, team strengths, knowing when to pivot when a market is not working. You know, they might try to, I'm thinking of, you know, Coke Zero, I think was one where they didn't market that well. It didn't sell that well. It didn't scale for whatever reason. So they had to pivot. That's an old school example. I'm sure there's, you know, other things that might be more apropos today.
Well, it's like in Amazon when it started out selling books, and then like now it's like they have ultimately pivoted to becoming one of the most powerful companies in the world, but they you can still buy books on Amazon. But they ultimately kind of aborted, or the efforts that were going into that to get to a actual objective that they were trying to get to in the end. And when you kind of look at that as like something that we were kind of talking about, earlier, like when you're talking about a startup or, either coming in and with your current positions, like with coaching, like when you go into a company and like that company has a broken leg. And it's just like, and we're trying to save you. And it's like when you're kind of going in there and some of these applications that you can draw and you say, okay, well, do you have an objective? Do you have like, do you know where things are? What is your communication streams? What are the sources of data that you're pulling from to give you relevant information? And things like that is something that's absolutely critical. I remember like, they're just a quick story and I'm probably telling it horribly, but it was, the first 3 months that we were in Afghanistan in 2013 was rough. Like we had the tanker break apart. We had the 747 that crashed. We had the Apaches that crashed. We had the MC-12 that crashed. Just a rough time. But like our weapons officers were unfortunately having to be Sandy pretty routinely. But like when we had some things like specifically the Apaches that crashed, like how it came down into the squadron was somebody was just like, with somebody who's like, hey, it crashed and we saw shoots. It's like, we saw this. It was like, that was not true. And you run with an entire game plan, 8 through 15, based off this piece of data. And you're just like, hey, what was the timestamp? What was the source? And like what was the timestamp and source of that information? And the answer is like, I don't know. Some guy just said it on the floor of the JPRC. And what that can do is you can take information, and if you don't vet that information, you can run a long way in the wrong direction, and then also get additional people killed. Because Kelso, I'll let you take this one, softball. What is the number one objective of CSAR?
Don't make more CSAR.
Yes. And so there, yeah, you
we don't
go.
Want to scale, like, that.
Yeah, scale that. And scale that to business. And don't make a bad situation worse. And then, Gunn, if you don't mind, like a question pops into my head. It's just like, when do you know? General Drolley, Johnny Bravo had the TED talk about the worst thing he had to do on in his career is say abort on the radio for a CSAR.
Yep.
Like, what things go through your mind, or either both of you as an RMC or anything like that, rescue mission commander, that you're just like, I gotta say abort. And we got to either do this another day. What is that?
Yeah. You know, that's a good segue. I think, you know, we talk about culture, right? And the Air Force has a culture, and then each community, A-10s have a culture, Vipers, light grays, dark grays, you know, SEALs, et cetera, you know, currently, you know, of course, CSAR has a culture. And I think what I saw during my time was our culture was, we're always going to give it a try. The weather's, you know, crappy. Well, let's stick our nose in it and see what happens. Right. The threat's too high. Well, let's just take off. And we got into it. You know, there's pros and cons to that. And I think part of that is what kind of the tenor and tone does the commander set at the highest level, whether they have launch or execute authority, and then really trying to decide. And these are really, you know, this is sometimes what the joint force commander or the combatant commander, gets to decide is, am I going to commit, you know, 14 people on a helicopter, whatever that force looks out to be, that's just the RV, but then also the A-10s in a very permissive environment. Of course, Iraq and Afghanistan, the next one may not be so permissive and so kind to us. But at what point do we assume the risk that we're going to go with an incomplete 15 line or 9 line, if you're doing a medevac, an incomplete, you know, picture, snapshot of data to go, all right, I think I've got enough to stick my nose in this and really commit those forces that they may not come back. And I think having studied this for, you know, a bunch of years, written some papers on it, I would say from the weapons school answer, it depends, because I don't think there's one concrete answer, because it's going to be so dynamic. And so I think in some respects, so emotional that they may personally know the individual, certainly at the squadron level, they probably know him or her. And you know, and as a parent, it's someone's son or daughter, you know, that's out there. And I think we're going to do everything we can to bring them back. And it may not be through the military side. It may be, you know, unfortunately, if they get captured, maybe there's a diplomatic solution. But to kind of drill down to that question, you know, it's tough. I think it's that kind of, you know, it's probably a little bit of experience, a little bit of gut, a little bit of intuition, and that kind of that hair on the back of your neck going, I don't like the way this looks. I don't know where that SAM threat is, or there's some ICOM chatter, or you know, somebody in over in this part of the intel community said, you probably shouldn't go to that part of the country or the AO because X, Y, and Z. And also as on the tactical side, you know, guys, used to be me, now it's you, because you're still in the fight, is what kind of permissions do you have to make the call at your level? And how far is the commander willing to go? And there's, you know, examples all over from Vietnam through Allied Force, through Desert Storm, Desert Shield, and even in, you know, probably in places like low intensity conflicts in Africa and things like that.
Yeah. Kelso, what's your thoughts on abort?
Yeah. So in case anybody doesn't know what abort means that might listen, that's when we decide we are not going to try to pick someone up. Typically because the threat is too great or fuel states are too low to successfully execute a pickup without thinking we're probably going to lose another aircraft or put more people out and be isolated. And I'll tell you, it is the hardest decision to make in all of combat search and rescue. The hardest decision is, should I say execute and commit all of these people and forces to pick this one person up or a couple people up? Or should I say, abort, let's go home and figure out a better way to try this again tomorrow. And it comes down a lot to experience. It's almost every person that goes through the rescue mission commander upgrade, we give them at least one mission where the right answer is to get on the radio and say the word abort. Because if they've never experienced it, they're not going to say that word in combat. And almost without fail, the first time they come upon the scenario where they should say abort, they say execute. And they commit the forces. And then in training, when nobody's actually going to die, they either get shot down by simulated threats or the survivor was a spoofer and he's holding a box that says bomb on the side. And as soon as the helicopter picks him up, it's a simulated helicopter explosion because we picked up the spoofer. And when they come back from that and they're debriefing and we play the tapes and we show them the situational awareness they had, they can see precisely when they decided to go a little bit past what they thought was acceptable level of risk. And someone else usually pays the price, right? Whether it's the helicopter, well, it's supporting suppression of enemy air defense fighters. Someone else pays the price for them making that decision. And that's when they learn that if I have a higher level of confidence that someone is going to get shot down in this attempt, then I have a level of confidence that we're going to get this pickup done and not lose any aircraft. I need to say abort on the radio, right? And the business translation I'll give you is the easy one of you're running a game plan. Blockbuster had a game plan, right? Blockbuster was freaking moving DVDs off the shelves. And somebody came in and said, hey, I think I've got a better idea for how to run this. You know, a little company called Netflix tried to sell themselves to Blockbuster a ways back. And Blockbuster's like, nah, I don't think so. We're feeling pretty good about this business model. We're going to execute on what we're doing, and we're not going to change the plan. And what ends up happening? Blockbuster ends up getting shot down, right? Yeah. For all intents and purposes, Blockbuster has been shot down. And now there's
that one in Alaska.
Yeah, that's right. There's one in Alaska for posterity, right? It's probably owned by the original CEO or something, and he just won't let it go. But that's the one of the easiest examples I could think of in the business world is when you're running the game plan and all of a sudden the market's bringing resistance, there's people that know how to say abort on the trajectory we're on. We need to shift vector and shift focus. And there's going to be this period of time, military side, we go back to the base and we're licking our wounds thinking, oh my gosh, we didn't get them. But when you come back the next day with a new plan that's better and you're able to shape the battle space the way you need to go pick the person up, that's when you're going to get that sense of gratification. And that's when you're going to get the mission done. And Gunn
probably like the same thing is like, and for a parallel, like with my wife's business or things like that, or business owners, is to your point about CSAR being an emotional mission. Like you might know the individual, like, someone's business, that is their baby. And so like that is their baby. And for it to start to fail or them to start having this doubt creep in that they can actually continue on the trajectory or achieve the objectives that they want. And for someone to come in and tell them is like, hey, you need to change the trajectory now or pivot and pick up this game. Or you know what? Let's abort. Let's come on back tomorrow. Let's kind of change this going on. That's going to eat at people. And so have you ever seen any of that, like in coaching, where it's just like someone's so unwilling to change their thought process because of the emotion that was involved, like in the business or the person on the ground?
Yeah, no, I love Kelso's example about Blockbuster. And interesting, you know, with CSAR is, I would say the survivor, Jack, has to be cooperative. I mean, it sounds so obvious that they want to have to get rescued. Okay, duh, that's the obvious thing. But are they trained? Do they know how to turn on their radio? Do they know how to, you know, do they know what's in their techniques and procedures? When's the last time they actually tried to evade? Do they know where the safe areas are? And I think if we look at Jack, the survivors or the survivor as the customer and listen to them for feedback, you know, now to Kelso's example, you know, the customer was probably telling Blockbuster, hey, we want to go someplace else. And that feedback, I think, is important because there's no business without a customer. Right. So listening to your customers. And I think, you know, to your point about coaching, I think with that is my technique with coaching, I don't tell them what to do. I want to pull out of them what they think they should do. I'll ask a lot of open-ended questions going, you know, and there's a bunch of different techniques you can do this. But I think, you know, if people get, you know, tied in their ways and they don't want to grow, I think that's really where the stagnation and the failure starts to happen. I think it was Eisenhower probably said, hey, plans are worthless. It's all about the planning. I like to say it's about the active verb. We can have plans come. We have plans on the shelf right now to go do lots of things. I have a plan to go mow my grass tomorrow. There's a plan to do this. There's a plan to do that. But I think it's the active and that the active verb of planning, right? So the current tense. But then it's also that activity, that culture, that mindset of you got to keep moving things and realize when the customer isn't ready for something, when the customer doesn't want something or they want something else. You know, Blockbuster is a great example. Toys R Us didn't learn and watch from Amazon. You know, Flash, we were talking about that. We're just talking about that with books. You know, MySpace versus Facebook. You know, VHS, if you remember that, versus Betamax. I mean, I'm that old, right? So, and the market will drive what the customer wants. In with that. And I think also, you know, with CSAR in the business examples, you have to be attuned to that. You know, we talked about, you got to be on the right net. You got to have the right fill. You got to be on the right frequencies And you got to listen to the intel, whether it's from Saddle, from ICOM, or from whatever, to make those missions effective.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And for those of us, I apologize not framing it, but when we talk about Jack, like Jack is the colloquial term of the objective, of the individual who is isolated, the target, if you will, of who we're attempting to pick up. And because you don't want to burn who they are or the fact that there is a PR or a CSAR going on. And so we use a lot, use the term Jack or the objective or their call sign. And you kind of go from there. So, all right, kind of moving forward, like when we look at what's a CSAR team, what's a PR team, like a task force, and then what makes a good team? So we're looking at kind of like the onion, if you will, to utilize, like when we're talking about colloquials and terms that CSARs use, and kind of go from there. And then what kind of parallels, like talking communication, like how do you set up a good, like how do you communicate amongst your team? But what makes a good team? Like how do you build the team? And then how do you take this team that you built and make it successful with the different underlying things that you build in your plan, like pulling that plan part kind of out?
I'll kick it off. So the first thing that every good team needs is trust. And it's something we don't talk a lot about in military operations between different types of aircraft, right? So like, we don't talk about like the F-35 needs to trust the F-22. You might talk about Flash needs to trust Hulk.
Yeah.
And it plays out the same way in combat search and rescue. Of the helicopter pilots have to completely trust the escort. So if I've got two A-10s that are off trying to find the survivor and they're trying to pin down the location and build that seven lines, I probably have two other A-10s that are escorting the helicopter in and looking for any threats to the helicopter around this 50 to 100 nautical mile route that they're going to fly to get there. And those two A-10s, I mean, it might be a flight lead who has 3 years of experience and 500 hours, and his wingman could be Joe Wingman with 100 hours of experience. They probably have three actual combat search and rescue missions under their belt and training. But they've learned how to escort helicopters and they've learned what the threats are. And they're going to give the helicopter directions like, hey, I need you to check 30 degrees left off the route. There's a threat 4 miles off your nose. I'm engaging. And then once they've suppressed that threat or destroyed that threat, they're going to check the helicopter back onto the route. And if that trust isn't there, there's this moment of hesitation. And that moment of hesitation can literally be the moment that gets you killed. I've got a good example doing a training mission on the Nellis Range during weapon school. There was one particular helicopter student who didn't quite trust me. We hadn't worked together. It was our first mission working together. Everybody's stressed.
Shocker.
I know, right? You're like, there's no way this guy knows where I should be flying my helicopter. And we get to the initial point and everybody's ready to go. And I call execute on the radio. And the survivor is only about 500 meters outside of a fairly large built up fake village known as Gotham, that like, as you can imagine, that is going to be a threat to any helicopter in the world. If like, if I need to pick somebody up 500 meters away from a city, that is a problem. Anybody in a window, they can be hiding weapons everywhere. Big problem. So he hits the initial point after the execute call, he starts heading in towards the objective area. And I kind of notice, I'm like, this dude looks like he's about 30 degrees off course. And he should be flying to a GPS steer point. Like this should be pretty locked in coming off the initial point. So, it's, you know, hey, Sting One, Sandy One, check 30 degrees left. You're off course. Sting One is the response on the radio. Sting One doesn't change direction at all. And I'm like, oh man, I have two other A-10s that are getting ready to put fires down in the direction that he's headed. Cause I've got diversionary and suppressive fires that are teed up that he doesn't know about, all this stuff. You fast forward another minute and a half, he should be over the objective. I've given him two more calls that he's off course. And finally, I have to tell him, like, Sting, hook back to the initial point. You're coming up on an active target area. And then the instructor finally takes controls, flips him back out to the initial point. We get back in the debrief, and turns out they
hit helicopter. That's a big deal.
That's a big
deal. It's going to take a while.
Yeah. And also, we're all going to see this ride again tomorrow because now we have failed. So we get back.
That never happened when I was a student.
Never, ever.
No, of course not. You nailed all your every single one.
So we get back to the debrief and we're talking about this. And I'm like, okay, what is the deal? Like, did you guys have the wrong coordinates? I asked you to check. You didn't do it. He's like, yeah, it turns out we had messed up one of the digits in the coordinates and we were headed 10 kilometers north of where the actual objective was. And I was like, okay, that's fine. Why didn't you check left when I told you to check left? He's like, well, you're telling me to do something. And based on my GPS, I thought you were out to lunch. And I'm like, okay. And I was like, this is a trust thing. And I was like, I need you to trust me.
Here's our DFP.
Right. Like, and it's a weird DFP, right? Debrief focal point. You don't normally have a debrief focal point at weapons school that's about trust. But it is absolutely inherent in everything we do. If I don't trust what you're telling me on the radio, there's a moment of hesitation or I'm going to check the data and I'm wasting time. And that's one of the things that I think in any good team, if you spend that first couple hours, couple days, however much time you have on building trust, get people to know each other, get to know each other on a personal level, that sets you up for success when it's crunch time. And I don't have time for you to question my decision. I need you to go and rapidly execute this. And that's the thing that I think you can pull out of probably any mission in the military that is immediately applicable in the civilian workforce of just trust is inherent in team building. So that's my big thing. I'll hand it off to Gunn for his additional thoughts.
Gunn, how do you communicate trust? And then like, as far as like plans, like how do you just say, nope, you know what? Yes, we could plan for another 6 to 9 months, but we're going to go violently now. And like, how do you communicate that?
Yeah, I think, you know, the trust, I think, is spot on. And really, it almost starts with all of the potential survivors, right? So those that are on the ATO, those that are flying off the carrier, flying the Army helicopters, or doing whatever, you know, each service is going to be responsible for their own, but then the Air Force brings in certain special capabilities. I think that trust, you know, first of all, starts with the customer, right? Jack, is that they have to trust us that we're going to go come get them. But, you know, we also have to trust them that they've read the special instructions. They know their techniques. They know how to turn on the radio, little things like that. It's not dialed back into someplace in the port and little things like that. And then I think, you know, so there's that basic blocking and tackling, but then also is that, you know, having that trust built in the, what I would call the times of non-conflict. And how do you do that? You do that in the bar, you do that in the training, you do that on the flight line, you do that in classes like weapons school, you do that in squadrons, and you get to know each other on a personal level. Hence it tends to get a little bit emotional, but that trust is really built with understanding everyone's, you know, strengths and weaknesses and capabilities. And then realizing that you, as you know, Kelso, you just talked about, well, I was following the needle, right? It's very, very predictable, right? I fell into that trap as well. But then realizing that someone else might have the data that you don't, you know, because you're up there at, you know, you've got the elevation and the altitude to have a different perspective of the picture. And I think, so I think, you know, with that, I think understanding how that trust is built and building that teamwork and really getting to know, I know an A-10 can do this, but an H-60 can't do that. But then also, you know, if you look at trust inside of the helicopter, the team, what I'm putting out, PJs, Guardian Angels, they have to trust me and I have to trust them. If I drop them off at Jack and I've got to get out of town for 10 minutes or 10 hours, that they're going to be okay. Right. They're an extension of the helicopter or the fixed wing, the C-130. I have to trust them that if they say something on the ground, like, hey, there is a truck approaching, there's an art, you know, whatever, a Dishka, blah, 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 blah. I have to trust them that they see what I don't. And I think ego gets in the way a little bit. And having that conversation of building the SOP, building the standards, and going from there. And I think, you know, also it's trust, but it's also communication. I think you can't have one without the other because, you know, we joke that CSAR, there's always the lesson learned of communication. But it's understanding that there's a common language. There's an interpretation. You may miss something. It may, you know, there may be a, like you said, a missed digit. We're all familiar with the 60-to-1 rule. You know, that's a lot of distance. Now you've got real problems, and yeah. And those mistakes cost time and cost money, and sometimes cost people their lives. So I think it's trust not only, but it's also communication as well.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Absolutely. And it's kind of one of those where when you're kind of talking about this is I don't subscribe necessarily to the to go back to an Air Force Academy example of like, hey, you didn't make your bed correctly, therefore you aren't going to be able to put bombs on target in combat. It's like doing the little things. I was like, how can I trust you to do the big things when I can't trust you to do the little things? It's like, well, there are things that are too little. But like when you're looking at some of this stuff is these things that you're talking about is affecting your own rescue. It's been communicated to me. Just give me a vertical head nod, I guess. But the most critical person in the CSAR is Jack. Like, correct. As far as just like being able to talk on the radio and like doing all these different things and doing the things you expect that you trust them to do so that you can actually do your job. And this buildup of little violations of tiny concepts over time erodes the trust and it completely shells the mission.
Yeah.
And so like to Kelso's point, numerous times I've seen two scenarios that are exactly alike. The only variable is that everyone's going to meet in the airspace with no mission planning and everyone is going to stand around a mission planning table and execute like everyone's or and plan it. And the number of times like on seed for a CSAR, which is impossible, by the way, you guys are like this, it's just terrible. Providing suppression of enemy air defenses for an actual CSAR is when I can look Kelso in the eye and you're just like, Flash, are you going to be there when I need you? Like when I say execute, are you going to be there with gas and weapons? And I look at him and I look him in the eye and I say, I'll be there, dude. It's like, that is significantly different than showing up in the airspace and Kelso being like, man, I hope Flash is there. And kind of going from there and being able to have that human trust and human interaction, same in the business world, is when you're looking at it, it's like having that human interaction that like the coach Gunn, for example, is just like, no, dude, I'm part of your team and my objective is your objective. And we can kind of go in there and let's stick to the plan. Let's not do our own thing. And let's get this done together.
So. Yeah.
And you know, Flash, one thing you were talking about, that trust and that confidence, you know, weren't doing a lot of CSARs in Afghanistan. It was a different kind of medevac, CASAVAC, but there was still capability. And during the time, I spent a lot of time in Bastion in the Southwest, down, you know, the Helmand River Valley and all that stuff. And the Brits were all over there, right? We were at Bastion and then Leatherneck,
yep.
You know, that combined base in the South. And we had multiple times and we got to know the Brits very well. We were part of their kind of operation and traded intel and stuff like that. But we would have the Brits call up into our talk and say, hey, are you guys up today? Meaning, you know, we good to go and on alert, everything's fine. Yeah, we're good. He's like, okay, great. He goes, I'll tell the boys. And what we found is when we picked them up that they fought harder knowing that we were going to come and get them, that we were at least going to try. And when one of the Brits, I can't remember when he told me this, but it was probably after some, you know, extraction or something like that. He goes, hey, thanks a lot. That really goes a long way. I think I knew that, but hearing it from, again, the customer saying, hey, Gunn, you know, I'm telling you something. This makes a difference that you guys will come and get us. That
and how we fight. Trust,
yeah, that communication. I said, well, that's great. I need you to put me out of business, but if we're there, we'll come help you. You know,
that's right.
So he got a chuckle out of that, but it's also true.
All right, I'm going to shift, and this is a little bit of an unpleasant portion and reality of CSAR. We talk about these things, and we've given some training examples and things like that. But really, when we're looking at this thing, is like when somebody's on the ground, that is a real world event. They are isolated. They are scared and so many other things. And like CSAR truly is, nobody nobody wants it to happen. Obviously, nobody wants that to happen. But Gunn had an experience in his career with dealing with loss, and somebody in his command, and is willing to share that story with us. And again, couldn't be more honored to have you be here to share that story. So take it away and tell us about Pedro 6-6.
Yeah, so I appreciate it. So I'll try and set the scene, and then we'll kind of talk about the event, and then we'll talk about maybe the post, which there's some bad news, right? Unfortunately, people died, but then there's some good news on the backside. So to give you the context, so it's 2010, 2000, you know, in Afghanistan, and in the CSAR world, part of our challenge is all the squadrons were different sizes. So some had 12, some had 8, and that caused a supply problem because the demand was so high, right? We were doing Iraq and Afghanistan. And there was this concept that the Secretary of Defense, I believe it was Gates at the time, said, hey, we're going to do the golden hour, going to get anybody off the battlefield inside of an hour. We had the capability. We don't have the Red Crosses. We have different weapons and things like that. And so we were coming in and out of Afghanistan, doing our things, you know, Bagram, Kandahar, Bastion, things like that. And all the active duty units and all guard and reserve units were deploying. And Flash, like we were talking, in my time in squadron command from 9 to 11, we were either in Iraq or Afghanistan or home. It was kind of that rotation. A lot of dwell issues. But and to solve that demand or that supply problem, to meet the demand over there, we did this thing called the Rainbow Coalition, right? We had, you know, usually the squadron commanders or the DOs would rotate command either in Iraq or Afghanistan. And in this circumstance, we had flight crews from my squadron. I was the 66th Rescue Squadron Commander. There was PJs from the 48th and Crows from the 58th. And that rotated every so often. And so it's now June of 2010. And Pedro 6-6, H-60, they're part of a two ship. They're going into a forward operating base, FOB Jackson. It's probably changed names a bunch of different times. I think they're on their third or fourth mission of the day. It's daytime, and they're picking up an injured British Marine, and they get hit by what we think is an RPG in the tail rotor. And so I owned the flight crew, but they were from my squadron. And when this happened, that they got shot down, of course, information is starting to come out. So you have 7 people on the helicopter, the flight crew, so the pilot, the co-pilot, and the gunner and the flight engineer were all from my squadron. The 2 PJs were from the 48th, and the Crow was from the 58th Rescue Squadron. They were at Nellis, and the 48th was down at Tucson. So to give you the names, it was Ken Wisniewski, Tony Simone was the were the 2 pilots. Wiz was the aircraft commander. Tony was the co-pilot. Dave Smith was the flight engineer on the right side. Chris Aguilera was the gunner on the left side. They're now called special mission aviators, but same thing. And then Joel Gentz was the Crow. And then Mike Flores and then Ben White were the 2 PJs. So a team of 3 in the back. So 7 total. And when they get hit, Wiz basically maneuvers the aircraft away from the ground force. And so they're in a FOB. There's HESCOs and things like that. The aircraft winds up crashing, you know, pretty violent, everything like that. Pedro 6-7 goes in to infill. The British Marines and the teams that were on the ground do the best to extract him. And what's interesting is I'm in a hotel in Baltimore going over to replace my friend, the squadron commander. And I wake up kind of, you know, just pop in the middle of the night. And I didn't know anything like this. And I'm like, I see it come across the scroller on the TV. And it says NATO helicopter crashes, you know, 4 injured. I'm like, well, that's interesting. And then I look at I think it was a BlackBerry. I look at my BlackBerry and I get a text or an IM or whatever it was from the guy who I'm replacing says, hey, call me. Hair on the back, you know, on my arms goes up. And I call him and he says, hey, this is what's going on. He tells me what he knows. And again, I'm in the hotel in Baltimore getting ready to get on the rotator that night. It's about 6:30 in the morning. So I call my leadership, tell them what's going on. Nobody had known anything. It kind of came all through me. And, you know, as information's coming, I now have to get I probably had about 20 or 30 folks, maybe a little bit more in the hotel. We're basically just doing a normal rotation. I had my first sergeant with me, and thank God I did, because he was the first person I called. So I said, hey, come on up in my room. This is what's going on. I said, here's what I know. Here's what I don't know. Then I think I called my wife, told her to get up, because at that point we kind of knew who was alive, who wasn't alive, who was injured and who wasn't injured. And again, seven folks on the helicopter. So, and I'm doing this on a BlackBerry on a phone, trying to relay, trying to get the information from Afghanistan, trying to relay it to my DO, who I've, you know, it's now 3 o'clock in the morning, Vegas time or whatever. He had just flown that night. I'm like, hey dude, get up. We got a big problem. And I think with that, I'll kind of give you a quick kind of pause in the story. You know, as a squadron commander, they give you the training. There's mortuary affairs. They say, okay, do this. I think that kind of gets you in the ballpark, but you really have, I'll tell you, I was completely unprepared. You kind of have an idea. And again, go back to that emotion. Of course, I knew all these guys. I knew their families. Certainly on the air crew side, I knew the team in the back fairly well, but not that well. And so now I'm talking to my first shirt. I'm talking to the guy who I'm replacing. And we were squadron commanders together. He was one of my students in the weapons school. You know, he's still in and serving and everything like that. So I'm trying to get information, relaying and all that stuff. And at this point now, social media starts to kind of come into play, right? Because everybody wants to know what's going on. And what made it a little bit more challenging was the helicopter was from one unit. The flight crew was from a different unit. The PJs were from a third unit. And the crow was from a fourth unit. So now you've got all this different, you know, we had an idea, but no one back home who didn't understand how we managed the crew and put people together really knew. So there's all sorts of things flying on social media. I don't even remember if I was on Facebook during that time, but my wife kind of had to, like, hey, you just gotta, hey, here's what's going on. You know, and with that, you've got obviously legal things. You've got next of kin notifications, which some people don't live in the most urban area. And so notifications were still in the process, and you really can't say anything to, but everybody knew. Any questions so far? I'll kind of pause there to see if that piques any interest.
Kind of the only question that comes to mind is just what was the first thing you thought of? Like, do you think of the fact, like, I mean, when you first heard about it, you didn't know that everybody had, that some folks had died, they were injured, like the information is coming in. Does your first thought go to, I need to get somebody in the air and accomplish the mission of picking them up? Or does the first thought go to the person, the people, and the families?
Yeah, no, your latter comment is spot on, because at that point, I'm not in charge. I'm literally sitting in a hotel room in Baltimore. There's a guy who's he's got a whole different set of problems. He's got, you know, I got to get these injured and the killed in action. I have to get them off the battlefield to a higher level of care. And meanwhile, you know, Pedro 6-7, their friends are picking up their friends. And that's, you know, you have to get your brain around that. And talking to some of those guys after I got into country, I think I understood it, but I really didn't understand it until you put a human connection and then you listen to the stories and you listen to the discussion and you try to get a better understanding, because I wasn't there and I had a different experience along a very long and difficult time. My concern was, a couple things. I want to do it right, but there's really no script for it, because
there's no
information
right
coming and going. We kind of had, I mean, the guy who I was replacing, he's like, this person has passed away, this person's passed away. So I'm taking notes. And really at that point, I start kind of formulating a plan going, okay, well, he's going to handle that side. I'm going to handle what I've got right in front of me, you know, handle what's going on, which was, I've got to take the 20 or 30 folks that I'm going to get on the rotator that night. And I've got to tell them, they still have to deploy. We didn't have time to go, well, we're going to take tomorrow and next two. No, we got to go.
No.
And then also I've got to figure out a way to get back home because I'm the commander. And I said, hey, to my buddy, I said, dude, you handle stuff in theater. I'll get there when I can. And a couple weeks later I did. So I've got to now figure out how to get home, which, okay, it's not that hard to hop on an airplane. But I think the hard thing was I tried to focus on what was in front of me. And that was, try to get as much information as possible and then get everyone together from my squadron, because we were the flight crews and the special mission aviators and the flight engineers and gunners. And I said, hey, you know, we're going to have a meeting at whatever time it was. I called everybody together, said, hey, here's what's happening. This is what I know. This is what I don't know. I think I threw a couple $100 on the bar. And I said, hey, we still have to go and deploy. And the plane leaves at whatever time. Not a really, you know, not a shining moment of leadership, but it's kind of what you had to do at the time. And I said, I'm going back to Nellis and going to start handling this. Because at that point, I wasn't really best suited to deploy. I had to take care of stuff back home because, we didn't know a lot of things. And like a lot of CSARs, which this was not, but in some respects, but usually sometimes the first reports really aren't accurate. And then they come in and you get more clarity. And in this case, it got worse because we started to learn the names. And then, you know, you've got to put the whole system in place about notifications. And the one thing I was really unprepared for, and this was in 2010, so 9 June 2010 is when the shootdown happened. Social media really wasn't, it was there, but it really wasn't big. I believe the iPhone came out in 2007. So we're really probably on like the iPhone 4 or BlackBerry, whatever it is. So, but still Facebook and social media, there was a lot of conflicting information because we had 3 units on 1 helicopter. And I think the helicopter was from a 4th unit, if I recall correctly. And again, this whole rainbow coalition. So I tried to sort through that, but I'm like, I can't really, I got to get back. So get back to the unit, you know, fly back to Nellis, notifications, you know, work their course, wind up going to a couple of funerals. And really with that, again, no script, you know, just kind of going with what kind of morals and values I was raised with. I talked to my boss, the group commander, talked to the wing commander, you know, both personal friends. And I said, hey, this is what I think. They're like, hey, you do what you got to do. And then still had to go and deploy, you know, I spent about 3 weeks at home. And then at the time I'm like, I got to go because I had to go replace my guy or the guy in my peer because he had been there. He'd been through a lot. So I go back over there and then really just try to pick up the pieces and go forward. And then I think, you know, looking back, there's a lot of lessons learned, a lot of things that I think I did right, that I think we as a team did right. And sadly, I've had some friends reach out when they've had accidents and crashes and things like that happen. But to the, you know, to the folks that died, you know, Wiz was the pilot. He was an Air Force Academy. So here's kind of the good stuff that happens out of this tragedy, right? So to kind of turn it into a more positive side. I still talk to the families of my crew members, the air crew. Wiz, the pilot, Air Force Academy grad, and I had an assignment to the Air Force Academy. He was from CS-26. And you'd bet you guys know they used to have phone booths, right? And what they did with the phone booth is it's actually kind of cool. They approached me and they said, hey, we want to do this thing for Wiz. And I'm like, great. And then I guess in the phone booth, which is built into the wall, they contacted his parents and the parents donated his A jacket, right? Is that what it's called? And a yep. bunch of things. And they made basically a display for Wiz.
Cool.
And we did a ceremony. And so that's cool. I'm getting chills just talking about it. That's very touching. Yeah. You know, and he's on the wall of honor up there. You know, that's one thing. For Smitty, who was the flight engineer, you know, I got to be actually pretty close with his mom. He was from Southern Alabama, you know, just salt of the earth folks. And a quick funny story about that to kind of lighten the mood here. So Alabama, Auburn or Alabama, right? You got to pick. You got to pick. And I grew up in Jersey and I didn't really follow college ball. I'm walking in like the big dumb moron that I am. So I go down there. And I think it was after the memorial service and I put on a shirt very, very similar to this and I come back and, you know, get knock on the door or whatever. And he has two sisters and some other siblings. And one sister works for Auburn roots for Auburn. The other one roots for Alabama. And I'm wearing the color of the opposite team of this. I can't remember the color, but the sister who answers the door was the Alabama fan. And I'm probably in an orange shirt. And she's like, "What is that?" And I'm like, "I don't know." And I'm thinking, I'm like, "What do you mean?" She goes, "Those colors are not coming in this house." And I had literally, again, didn't know the whole Alabama Auburn thing, kind of had an idea, but didn't really know. And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I have screwed this up already." I'm like, "It just came from the memorial service." And they're like, "No, no." And then the mom shows up and she's like, "Would you leave him alone? Just stop. He's coming in the house." And they're like, you're not crossing this threshold with that color. And the mom was like, "Just, you know, go away. He'll be fine." And so that kind of broke the ice. And we had some memorial bracelets that we all brought for them. And then, you know, over the years, I had an assignment to War College, which is up in Montgomery. They lived in the Mobile area. And I would go down there and see her every once in a while. Sadly, his mom passed away. Smitty's mom passed away a couple of years ago. But we stayed in touch. We talked quite a bit. You know, Tony, so Wiz and Smitty were the two folks from my squadron that passed away. For the two survivors, you know, Tony Simone, he's driving a car. He's got two more kids than he had before. He lives outside of Chicago. That guy, he's got the saying of Semper Gumby. He's always positive, upbeat, just, you know, and his dad is just as great. His dad was in Vietnam, Marine. Man. Just, you know, lives up in Pennsylvania, just, you know, and when Tony was recovering, we're at Brooks, which I believe is in San Antonio, might be a lack on it, can't remember. He brings, a cigars and a bottle of Jack Daniels. And we just, you know, got to know each other over that. And I still talk to him. We still talk a lot. And then Aggie, the gunner, he's just a powerhouse. Again, when I was at the academy, he lives, out west, he was in the Invictus games. He came out to the academy. He's doing all sorts of good things. And then, of course, you know, with Joel, here's the other small world guy who I know through some aviation connections. He went to college with Joel. Joel was the crow. He went to Purdue. And so we had a discussion about that. You know, they've named streets after some other folks. You know, Michael Flores was the other, was the PJ. He was from the 48th. And then Ben White was also the other PJ. But, you know, throughout this, each of the squadron commanders from the 48th, 58th, and the 66th, you know, we all had our own journey and path, but we all learned from each other. And you know, dealing with loss, it's taught me that while terrible and tragic, there can be some good out of it. You know, I think we all learned. I know I've learned, you know, a lot about the human condition, the service and sacrifice that the member does, but then also what the family endures, too. And I think that can't be lost, that, you know, the families, you know, both whether they're spouse or kids, but then the parents too, I think is an important, because they're the sons and daughters, right? They're doing their thing, and the parents are supporting them as best they can.
Man, I can't imagine. Cannot imagine, you know, as somebody that's hoping to be a squadron commander in the next year or two, I'm thinking through this and I'm like, I remember my first deployment before we left, the squadron commander had everybody write a letter that was to their spouse or closest loved one. That was an open, if I don't come home letter. And the squadron commander held on to all of them. And that was the first time I realized the gravity that comes with being in a command position was if something happens to one of us, you know, a paid was going to have to be the guy to take the unopened letter to the spouse or the mom, whoever the closest relative was. And that's got to be just ridiculously difficult to do.
Yeah. You know, like I mentioned, there's, you know, for me, it was a lot of faith, a lot of prayer, having a fantastic, you know, spouse to kind of handle that side. And I don't mean to say there's a division, but, you know, the spouses, they bear a lot of the stress and the burden, and the kids too. It was, and I guess if there's any positive, you know, amongst the other things that I talked about is, you know, you try to comfort them as much as they could, continue the relationship. And I would ask them, I said, hey, you know, we don't have to talk. They're like, no, I actually appreciate it. Because it's their life. You know, I was their commander and was the time, in their life. And I still talk to, you know, most of them, of the parents, and some of the siblings as well, but I let them really, you know, kind of drive it. And that's, you know, Kelso, to your point, that's the tough thing about command because of the business that we're in, not necessarily in combat, but also in training too,
right.
You know, there's that avenue, you just try to do the best you can and learn. And again, you know, the theme, what we talked about is you've got to build that trust. You've got to build that communication. You got to have a team too. I didn't do it. There's no way I did any of this alone. You know, I had a shirt. Actually, I think I had two shirts for one point. I had a fantastic DO. I had a wonderful spouse's group, a group commander, a wing commander that was great. And then, you know, we've got some charitable organizations that Others May Live was really good. They help nice. Kind of step in and fill the gap. They're fantastic. You know, witnessed what they did to a tremendous success. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah. Well, Ash, we've talked about
that's
it.
That's kind of the, oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
We've talked about this, man. Like as a military, we've been pretty lucky over the last 20 years that there aren't a lot of commanders with that type of experience. But if there is a peer fight on the horizon, a lot of people need to hear that story. A lot of people need to start coming to grips with what it's going to take to deal with loss, what it's going to take to look family members in the eye, let them know their son or daughter isn't coming home. So I appreciate it, Gunn. I'm glad you're willing to share this story in public because hopefully a lot of people will be able to tune in and listen.
Yeah. It's one of those conversations and those issues that you don't really want to talk about, but you have to be aware of what you're getting involved in.
Right.
And whether it happens in combat or happens in training, certainly combat, you know, there's all sorts of different dynamics. And sadly lost people in training as well. Because at the end of the day, it's all about people and it's all about human to human connection, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
I hear it
kind of like a little bit all too often. And it's something that I've learned from my dad as well. And guys like yourself, Gunn, like where I was growing up and I got to be around folks that either had been in squadrons that dealt with loss or anything like that, whether in combat or in training or whether in just whatever. But like in today's, like Kelso's kind of talking about in relative peacetime, and then even like in the global war on terror that we had was, yes, there was 5,000 people that lost their lives in those conflicts. And he's like, but I mean, in World War II, we're talking in the millions. And so when you look at it, as we transition to kind of like great power competition, as we go here, and I hear it talked about all the time, is it's like when you become a DO or a commander, this is like, it's a reward. It's like, it's a reward. And people look at this command as like the next path in my career to whatever I'm going to accomplish. And he's like, no, this reward can become a burden very quickly. And then when you say, when I say a burden, I mean like a sacred trust that you have with the people that you are in charge of, or you are leading and things like that. And I think that unfortunately at the moment is starting to get a little bit lost. And then like to Kelso's point, it can come back very quickly. So last real question as we kind of start to wrap this up is, what do you think, like if you could look back or look forward, if you will, or when you're coaching somebody and you say, hey, you know what? The command that I had and the experience that I had in this conflict, the parallels that I can draw on, the things I can impart on you, where potentially in the next conflict is going to have that happen like hourly. And like when you say like some of these things, how do you prepare a commander for that? How do you prepare a leader for that? Or how do you prepare a military for that matter? Like as somebody who has been a commander, and I understand that is an impossible question to answer, but it's one that folks are going to have to do and they're going to be called upon. And you're one of the, and like Kelso said, we're lucky. Like you're one of the guys, like one of the few that has had to experience this.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a good answer to that question.
There's not. Yeah, sorry. And apologies.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the curveball. I think a couple things. I think as a commander, I think you have to do a couple things. I think you have to realize that you are now so others oriented that you are, you know, and if you look at a triangle, right? Most people think the commander's up at the top and everybody's at the bottom. I look at it as it's the inverse, right? The commander is at the bottom and taking care of everybody else. I think you put yourself second, third, or fourth, you're others oriented. You're always worried and concerned about, you know, is the airman getting their pay? Are they, you know, are they getting childcare support? Are they getting whatever? And so I think you have to be others oriented first. I think secondly, you have to be probably a student of history. And, you know, Kelso, you talked about Battle of Britain, right? There's these challenges that we're facing may be something new, but are the solutions any different than what Battle of Britain and the volume? And I don't know, maybe not. And I think a couple more things is understanding that the business of the military, right, executing policy and all that stuff and Clausewitz and Sun Tzu and all the other stuff that nobody really remembers when we're reading it in war college or, you know, ACSC by correspondence or whatever. But when it comes time and the bullets start flying, that stuff really does matter. That it is a business of killing the enemy and taking their shit. Right. And that could be whatever the politicians want or whatever the civilian leadership wants. That's what we do. Sadly, there's a bad side to it, and that could be giving your life. And I think in terms of preparing commanders, I think let me kind of go a little bit deeper. You can never do it by yourself. Right. We all have bros. There's a bro network. You've got fellow squadron commanders. You're always going to have to rely on somebody. You know, one thing at Nellis when I was a squadron commander, the maintenance commander, he had his office and he taught me so much about leadership. He was a major and he had probably 400 folks. And I would go over there and I was an 05. I outranked him, of course, but he had so much more experience about dealing with people and problems. But then also, you know, flash to your point is coaching them through. It's in Vegas. So you got a young airman who's got all of the draw of Vegas. We spent multiple times there. You know, if you want trouble, you can find it and probably not pay a lot for it. Right. In Vegas. And so you have to build, and I think you have to build your network. You have to build what I call your, you know, some would call it a board of directors. Some would call it a brain trust. There's friends in your circle, my circle. I know if I have a technical problem, I'm going to call this person. If I have a leadership problem, I'm probably going to call him. If I got a completely crazy wild idea, I'm going to call my buddy who's going to talk me off the ledge going, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. Or I'd like to invest in your crazy idea. And then, you know, that takes care of kind of the up and out to your military side. But then I think also down and in is you know, whatever family dynamic and family structure you have, spouse, partner, whatever, aunt, uncle, grandparent, both as a commander, but then also understanding what the family dynamic of the people that you're leading is. Not everybody has parents, not everybody has a solid home network, home base. Understanding what down and in looks like and where you find your support. Some people find it in faith, some people find it in religion, some people find it in their spouse, working out, whatever. I think you have to be willing to look down and in of where you get your strength and support. And when you come home and have a bad day, and there will be bad days, but there's also going to be good days, of where you go to get recharged and refreshed, and realizing that just like a sports analogy, not every athlete is going to play every play. If they do, there's going to be burnout, there's going to be injury, there's going to be, you know, drop balls, missed catches, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know if that's kind of how I approach it. And I think lastly is, I think constantly figuring or having a desire to keep learning and watching other folks. Like I told you, the example of the maintenance squadron commander, I would go over there and just watch him hand out discipline sometimes. He goes, you just sit in a corner and I was like, ooh, this is juicy. And then he would tell me the backstory, like, he did what? And then again, it's Vegas. And we still talk to this day about some things. And I reminded him, he just recently retired. And I'm like, hey, do you remember those days? He goes, oh, I remember those days. And a quick flashback. You remember, I think it was in 07, I think when Mosley was saying that maintenance and ops are going to come together, right? And then yep. Mosley and the SecAf kind of get dismissed. And I remember, I'm like, how in the God's green earth, you know, am I going to have a 150 person flying squadron and then 400 people in Maine? I'm like, I have no idea how I'm going to do this. And that's where I got to be better friends with him, because I'm like, hey, how are you going to run the maintenance side of me running? He goes, no, you own it all. And then thankfully, I think it was, who was the chief? Yeah. It was Norty Schwartz. I think it was the first thing when he got nominated to become the chief. He's like, okay, we're stopping the merger. I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
So
division labor is good.
Those are just some of them.
There's probably a handful of maintenance airmen out there that tell their friends, they're like, yeah, I got this Article 15. And there was some random lieutenant colonel I had never seen before just sitting in the room staring at me. You know, the other side of that story is probably really funny.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
He brought this lieutenant colonel in there to discipline me even harder. It's like little do they know. It's just like, I'm just actually learning how to write an Article 15 over here.
Yeah.
But you know, fun fact, when I had some issues, like it was a DUI or somebody in the squadron or whatever, I would call him. I'm like, hey, here's what I got. What do you think? He goes, uh-huh. He goes, that's a really stupid idea. And here's why. I'm like, man. You know, and whether he knew it or not, which I think he did because he's very smart, he was mentoring me. You know, the rank didn't matter. I just needed that.
Yeah, his experience.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'll pose another question, Kelso. This one over to you or Gunn or your thoughts on the whole thing. But when we talked about like that GWAT great power competition, like as far as like a commander or just being prepared for that kind of fight versus the fights that we have grown up in. Like the commanders now grew up in the fight as captains, lieutenants, captains, majors in the Afghanistan kind of fight as we go forward. But it's just like, in your opinion, like, and obviously keeping it at the classification level that we can, is in the event of conflict with a peer adversary or a pacing adversary, not going to name names or anything like that. Are we prepared to conduct CSAR in that environment? Are we like, where are we? What could we do better? And then what's it going to take to actually hold the line and keep the bond that we've kind of created that we talked about at the very start, the trust that we are going to come get you. And where are we in life?
Yeah.
In 2024.
So I'll give you the quick snapshot. There are certain areas of that battle space where you are not doing CSAR. You are waiting for something to drift to a different location where you can do CSAR. There's areas where you are absolutely doing CSAR. There are places where if someone gets shot down, 100%, we're going in, we're going to get them out, and we're going to get back on the flight line in a couple of days. Then there's what I call the middle zone, which is, we are prepared to do CSAR in some of the portions of the middle zone, and we are wildly underprepared to do CSAR in other portions of the middle zone. And the thing that's going to make that middle zone grow is training and integration. You know, can we get F-35s to start training to seed support for CSAR? Can we get F-22s and F-15EXs to start training to RESCAP, where they're providing air-to-air coverage over a CSAR that's going on underneath? Because the helicopter pilots, the HC-130 guys, and the A-10 guys are going to be as ready as they can be. But those three platforms are not enough to execute CSAR within the acceptable level of risk in the middle zone. I rely on fast jets. I rely on the intel community. I rely on national assets. And if those three different types of people are not training to this mission set regularly, there are now gaps in where I can do CSAR and stay within the acceptable level of risk. So that would be my assessment right now, is like, yeah, there's places where we'll come get you. There's places where no matter how much iron and how much Schlitz I put into it, I cannot get you. But then there's the middle zone. There's the inches that we have to claw for in the training environment. You know, you're clawing for every inch, right? And how do you do that? Go participate in a CSAR exercise. You know, if you're an F-35 pilot, are you carrying a 15 line in your pubs bag? If you're an F-22 pilot, Have you ever done escort for a CSAR? If not, ask for that opportunity. Because even if you just learn a little bit, I just gained a couple more miles that I think I can get CSAR done in that environment because somebody has the experience and they know what they're doing. That's my personal assessment.
Yeah. And it's kind of the point where you're saying is I've heard a lot, especially in my community. Like when I say these things, that growing up in the A10 community, it was near and dear to my heart. Like I always wanted to be Sandy One. Didn't make it. That's okay. I got guys like Kelso, and but I've heard guys in my community just like, well, doing seed for a CSAR is going to be the same. And I'm just like, not when the striker and the protected entity is going 2 miles a minute. I was like, and all these different things, like you're gonna have to do different things. And same thing is, it's like, well, it's just DCA. Like the protected entity is behind me and like, I'll press out forward. It's like, no, it's not. It's just not. And like the concepts are similar, but it's just wildly different. You have to hear the different comm on the radio, the pacing, all these different things. And you have to go out and you have to be in that environment. And then second to that, is as we talked about on the bro chat, is like the hog is going away. The corporate knowledge cannot. And it's like that decision has been made. And it's just like when you're looking at A1s to A7, like all the different people that were Sandys in Vietnam, and it's just like, and now coming back out to do that, somebody else is going to have to pick up that mantle. And it needs to happen a year ago. And go ahead, yeah. Gunn.
And the platforms are going to change, right? I mean, we use A1 Sky Raiders and H3s and 53s, but the culture should be continual, right? And we may not say, or we may think that, you know, great power competition, are there going to be CSARs? There might be. Are there going to be personal recovery missions? Most likely. And when you have a crash or a shoot down, doesn't have to be a threat. It could be just, look at the EP3 that wound up, you know, off the coast of China.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that tended to be somewhat of a chocolate mess for a lot of different reasons. And that we weren't even in conflict then. But I think also with that is
I'm trying to lose track of whether we're at war or not these days sometimes.
It depends on how you define war, right? It depends, right? It was always the answer. It's still applicable. I use it on my family. It drives me crazy, but it still works.
It's what I don't want to answer.
But I think we have to realize that when you get, and you could call a shoot down or a crash a tactical event, but that tactical event, even somebody getting washed overboard on a ship, that is going to have operational, strategic, and national and global problems very quickly. And we've seen that with, you know, hostages, you've seen that with people that have gone missing in combat and extremist situations, right? There's organizations that are looking for people that have been kidnapped from Iraq for 15 years. You know, there's still organizations that look for people, you know, the POW MIA office, they're still digging remains up from Vietnam. And I think that kind of goes to that emotionality, if that's a word, and that moral imperative of the fabric of this country and the culture that CSAR and PR brings. Agnostic of who's doing it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's not about the platforms. It's about the continuance of culture. It's about the continuance of being able to achieve the effect of CSAR and personnel recovery is the most important thing that has to happen. So, guys. Oh, go ahead, Gunn.
I was going to say the last thing I'll pile on with that is I don't think the parents care who picks up their kid. They do not care.
That is exactly how we should end this episode right there. Is they don't. It just has to happen and it has to continue. So guys, I appreciate it. Gunn, thanks so much. Any parting shots as you're heading out?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it and be on the podcast. It's been great fun.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Thanks so much. And thanks so much for sharing your story. Kelso, finish this out.
Thanks for having us on.
All right. Love it. Thanks, guys. Hey, all you guys, hope you enjoyed this episode. If you liked it, subscribe, listen to us more. We got people. We got guests coming on. Gunn, you've been one of the best. Kelso, thanks for everything. Appreciate it. To our Patreon supporters, please, that we thank you so much for all this. And have a great rest of the day. See ya.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately, well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold in the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the Hurt Locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yep, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.